Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We have another great show in store for you today. To check out our latest commentary, go to our blog at currentevents247.blogspot.com. That's CURRENTEVENTS 24-7.blogspot.com. I would like to say greetings and salutations to everyone tuning in from Australia, Asia, Africa, Antarctica, Europe, and of course, North and South America. Jima and I are excited to be with you once again. And today's topics include the unveiling of the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial and the 48th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Sherry Lanford Smith joke. Yes, that's right. The chairwoman of the Sumter Tea Party in South Carolina makes an off-color remark about the president and the first lady. We'll also be discussing ESPN making Michael Vick white to see how people will react. I would like to know, how was your response? And of course, Bishop Eddie Long is back in the news, and much, much, much more. So, sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, that number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comments. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. But first, let's take a look at our current events. Before we begin today, I would like to take a moment to talk about the weather out east. Now, the Washington Post is reporting that the most powerful hurricane to threaten the eastern seaboard in almost two decades hit the Washington region Saturday, bringing heavy rains and high winds that plunged homes into darkness, turned trees into projectiles, and caused at least eight deaths. Now, early Sunday morning, the storm's toll in damage and outages continued to rise in the Washington area. Evacuations were underway in St. Mary's County as water rose behind a dam at St. Mary's Lake. There was damage reported to at least two buildings in the district, one of them at Georgetown University. Now, I just want to say that our prayers are with the families of the hurricane and the earthquake victims that were hit this week. Also, I want you to call your friends and family members and also your coworkers that are out there in the region. Ask them if they need anything. You know, in these tough economic times, recovering from any type of displacement or death can be devastating to a person and their finances. So anything that you can do for them, I'm sure they'll be really appreciate that. And this is yet another opportunity for people to call their insurance agency. I want you to take time out this week to call your agent to find out what type of homeowner policies or renter's policy, for that matter, that you have. Ask them, you know, a couple of serious questions about your policy and what they cover. Now, what many people fail to realize is that the typical homeowner's policy doesn't cover flood damage, nor does it cover some of the natural disasters such as tornadoes, hurricanes, or earthquakes. Now, I want you to make sure that you listen in really well to this. They are separate policies. Again, they are separate policies from the typical homeowner's policy. You have to ask specifically for that policy. So if you're under the sound of my voice, call your agent. Ask them the simple question. If my home is hit by an earthquake, am I covered? If a tornado or a hurricane strikes, am I covered? What about in the event of a flood? Am I covered? And if in the past you thought you were safe, well, I believe that there is evidence to suggest that climate change is happening and happening frequently. And consequently, the weather patterns are getting more and more unpredictable. So I encourage you to make the call, make the call, make the call. Now, I'm not going to belabor that point. I hope that you take heed to this particular suggestion because I actually called this week and I found out some things I really had no idea of. For example, flood insurance is not even covered by my existing agent. It is something that's covered by the government, and I didn't know that flood insurance, at least that's what they quoted me, that had to be paid up front. It's like $300 or $400. And you have to wait 30 days before it even be covered. And that is the disclosure that they gave me. Also, the fact that if, I'm in the Dallas area, so if a tornado comes and if it hits, you know, your homeowner has to be covered by that wind policy. So, you know, again, I encourage you to make the call, make the call, make the call. Now, on to our top stories of the day. And first up is the unveiling of the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial. Now, here's a report from the New York Times. It says that after more than two decades of planning, fundraising, and construction, the Martin Luther King Jr. National Memorial, a four-acre tract south of the mall featuring a granite statue of Dr. King, has officially opened to the public. The memorial was planned to be formally dedicated on today, Sunday, August 28th, in a ceremony that was expected to draw hundreds of thousands of people from around the country. Now, the dedication was going to include remarks from the president in observance of the 48th anniversary of the March on Washington, and Dr. King's, and I put this in quotes, "I Have a Dream" speech delivered at the Lincoln Memorial. Now, well, technically, the speech was not called the "I Have a Dream" speech. In fact, most historians say that written across one of the drafts of his speech was "Normalcy Never Again." But nevertheless, people call it or is most notable for the "I Have a Dream" component. And what we're going to talk about today is a different part of the speech, the beginning of the speech. We're going to talk about the bounce check portion of the speech. And that's going to be talking. At any rate, today I want to talk about that speech, and I want you, the listeners, to voice your opinion about where we are compared to 48 years ago when he made this speech, and use Dr. King's yardstick to see where we measure up. Okay? Also up, we're going to talk about another interesting story. Now, this was about Sherry Lanford Smith. She's a chairwoman of Sumter Tea Party in South Carolina. Now, she posted a joke on her Facebook profile, and it's kind of startling what she said. I'm going to read it, and I want to get your reaction right after the break. So, it says, "Obama looked at Michelle," and this is what Sherry Lanford Smith wrote on her Facebook page. She posted it, and she said it was a joke. She says, "Obama looked at Michelle, chuckled, and said, 'You know, I could throw a $1,000 bill out of the window right now and make somebody very happy.' Michelle shrugged her shoulders and replied, 'I could throw 10 $100 bills out of the window and make 10 people very happy.' Now, hearing their exchange, the pilot of the plane said to his co-pilot, 'Such big shots back there. I could throw both of them out of the window and make 256 million people very happy.' And she goes on to say, if you're one of the 256 million, pass it on. Now, what do you think about this joke? Was this in fact a joke? Interesting, interesting indeed. Also, we're going to talk about the ESPN, the magazine, and what they did. Now, I don't know if you heard this or not, but ESPN, the magazine, has been relentlessly criticized this week for publishing an article headline, "What if Michael Vick were white?" Now, I believe it was not so much of the article that stirred everybody up, but it was the image of Michael Vick being white that sparked the outrage. Now, what I found to be most interesting was that some of the harshest criticism of that imagery came from the actual author of the article, who goes by the name of Touré. Now, who had nothing to do with the choice of the art accompanying his writing, but he did write the article. Now, Touré has made numerous media appearances to distance himself from the picture of the white Vick and said that he was dismayed and horrified by the image. Now, ESPN is usually deft at ignoring its critics, but the criticism over the picture of the white Vick was apparently too much to dismiss. And as ESPN, the magazine editor-in-chief, Chad Millman, has released a statement attempting to explain what he was thinking when he decided to publish this particular image. So my question to you today is, why are people so outraged about the image? Now, I would love to get your comments on any or all of these issues. So to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we're going to open up the phone lines, take your calls, and, of course, get my co-host, Jima, to weigh in on these and other issues. We'll be right back. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com. And click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. We're going to open up the phone lines and then we're going to hear from our listeners. And in the meantime, I'd like my co-host, Jima, to weigh in on these issues. Jima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Now, as I said earlier, today marks the 48th anniversary of the March on Washington and what many people have come to call Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech delivered at the Lincoln Memorial. Now, well, I want to take this opportunity to move beyond the dream and to take a hard look at reality. I want to take a deeper look at the speech and discuss with our listeners and you, of course, to see how we measure up 48 years later. Now, let's take a moment to listen to a part of the speech that often gets overlooked.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to whichever American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds.
Okay, so typically when people talk about this speech, they always talk about the dream, and they always talk about the portion that he talks about, you know, the judging someone for the content of their character as opposed to the color of their skin. I want to move the conversation beyond that. I want to talk about the part of his speech where he talks about, but 100 years later, the Negro is still not free. He writes, 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. So, Jima, I ask you, 48 years, or should I say 148 years later, how are we measuring up to this, to the manacles of segregation?
Well, it's unfortunate, but I don't think that we are measuring up as high as we possibly could. We've allowed ourselves to be taken advantage of, not only by a system, but we've allowed ourselves to be taken advantage of by one another. We haven't completely lived up to anything. We haven't done anything great in a long time. America in general hasn't done anything great in a long time. But we, in my opinion, Black Americans have not done anything great in a long time. And so we failed ourselves as well. America has failed us in not delivering on the promise, but we failed ourselves in failing to continue to fight for the promise as well.
Okay. I'm going to also go to our phone lines right now, and I'm going to ask the people that's on the phone line, if you press 1 to talk, and then if you just want to listen in, you can just listen in. But if you want to join in the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712, and just press the number 1 to talk. I'm going to go to our phone lines. Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Caller from last four, 7102. What's your name and where are you calling from?
This is the Esquire, Abby Phelps, also known as the Motor City Maharani. Thank you for the invite, Patrick. Love being on the show.
Oh, it is awesome to have you with us. So we're kind of going back and talking about I'm going to say the I Have a Dream speech because that's what people know it by. But we want to break the speech down, and we want to talk about the earlier portion of the speech. So I have a question that's on the floor right now, and it talks about, he said, 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. How has that evolved over the last 48 years, Abby?
You know something, thank you for that question. Powerful question, as always. We know you come up with something interesting. I agree with what Jima just said. I'm going to take it a little bit deeper. The whole battle was once the systematic level of exchange in which we operated under whether it was the preoccupation of racial prejudice and Jim Crow. We've now translated that battle amongst ourselves. We're competitive with each other. We're not supportive of each other. It's black-on-black crime. You know, it's a disrespect of community, disrespect for our educational system. The village concept has literally decimated into nothingness. So the battle that was once external from the other laterals of society, which is fighting against racism and inequality, has now translated into a microcosmic socialistic battle in which we're doing amongst ourselves. And that's why I say it's such a thing as physical, manual slavery, and psychological slavery. So many people of our credence, and I hate to say it, but the truth lights the way to the door, have become enslaved within their mind. They're not about building, not about being edificational. They're not about trying to empower our nation and our people to move forward. It's all about me, myself, and I. And if you're outside the equation, well, you don't measure up. And that's what I see. We have definitely deviated from that dream. It's turned to a literal nightmare in the lives of so many people as we see the escalation, 10% increase in the homicide rate, even in the city of Detroit. You know, it's not only in Detroit, it's across the nation. We have become our own worst enemies. Instead of facilitating forth with the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King, we are now becoming like Freddy Krueger's with the Nightmare on Elm Street and on everybody else's street.
You know, that was an interesting book by Naeem Akbar called Breaking the Chains of Psychological Slavery. Now, I would encourage all other listeners to go out there and read that book. I read that book several years ago, and it changed my perspective of what's going on with, I want to say, the African-American people and our culture. You know, and it's an interesting book. I'm not going to – I'll probably discuss the book sometime in the near future, but I would encourage you to, you know, go out there and get that book. So the second thing I want to – second question I want to pose to you, Jima. Now, you know, of course he said 100 years later the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled, but he also says crippled by the chains of discrimination. Are we still locked in the chain of discrimination since 48 years later, since he made that speech, Jima?
For sure. We're locked in the chains of discrimination, and as he stated, crippled by the manacles of segregation, because we have allowed ourselves to be segregated. We have allowed the system to not do what it said it was going to do, and we've turned our back on our own best interests. And so because we've done that, those chains are still there. Our education systems are still separate and unequal. They're not equal by any stretch of the imagination.
That's
you
right.
have to be a parent that is diligent and that is consistent in your child's school every single day. You have to force educators to teach your child, and you have to force educators to do what they have been hired to do. And so that's one area we're discriminated against. We know, you know, in terms of jobs and things of that nature, we are, you know, the highest level in terms of unemployment. That hasn't changed a lot. We've always had double unemployment. It was just not double-digit unemployment. But now that we're double-digit unemployment, we want to spend some time talking about it. The night before he died, he was there about poverty. He was there about the sanitation workers. The March on Washington was for jobs. So here we are 48 years later, and we're still talking about jobs and the need to have them in our community, the need for our community to be invested in. But the flip side of that is that what we don't have that they had then is a sense of community, a sense of pride in community. I'm not sure I'd want to put a business in my old neighborhood back in Kansas because I don't trust the people in the neighborhood to support it. I don't trust the people in the neighborhood to take care of it, to not come in and vandalize because of the nature in which we live. Somewhere somebody put out, whoever that marketing person was, somewhere they put out that because you have nothing, you don't want nobody else to have nothing, so
that's
destroy everything around you. And so it's because of that we have, that we're still faced with those high levels, and we're still bound by these chains of discrimination, for sure.
So, Abby, what do you say when someone says that the African-American people are only 13% of the population, and the fact that the majority are the Caucasians or the whites, or some in numbers are upward of 65-70%. And when you talk about discrimination, and then you put it in the same context of an African American president in the White House, can't we say we've moved beyond past discrimination? Because if you look at the data, and that we're only 13% of the population, and there's no way we could have a black president in the White House unless we were not discriminated upon. What do you say to that?
That's right. We've made some levels of progress in certain aspects of society, and I hate to be so blunt, but I have to tell it like it is. After George W. Bush made the biggest mess possible of our nation, of our economy, of our societal structure, and destroyed and decimated the relationships we had around the world, of course they had to pass the baton on to someone else who was not ascribed within the same ranks of the ethnicity that George W. Bush was. So not the fact that Obama was not a white man, but he was the right man because he had a lot of experience in that area of building relationships. This is the reason why his campaign was so successful. He believed in the grassroots initiation of involving the people because he believed that the government described the needs of the people and the people should be ascribed to the needs of the government. And so that's the reason why I believe that he was very effective in that content. But as far as the discrimination factor is, it's true. It's still present and prevalent. And I want to take your mind back to a very famous speech by Willie Lynch. You know, he said, we take the lighter-skinned blacks and plop them against the darker-skinned blacks. You have that racism, that prejudice right inside of the black community, where lighter-skinned blacks are oftentimes treated with more privileges and opportunities than darker-complected people. And because I have keen European-type features, I'm just being realistic, and, you know, and the texture of my hair and the medium reddish-brown skin, and I've noticed it. I'm oftentimes treated far better than that darker complected person with the more coarser type of hair. Why? Because we have learned to be programmed by a European-based society that gives us the ethics of what beauty is and what beauty isn't. So if you're lighter skinned, you have the European features, you know, you have your hair straight, dyed an unnatural color, and formulated to a condition of albinism, which I mean blonde, quote-unquote, be not, you're considered pretty or beautiful. But if you have the broader features and you have a darker skin and the more coarse checked texture hair, and your body is a little bit more ample, you're considered ugly. Why? We've been programmed into prejudice. Distinctive characteristics of discrimination, we've been embedded with us. Many of us have been embedded and don't even know we're infected with that disease. And I see it every day, even as being an educator, as being a motivational presenter. I look at things. I observe things, how we respond and how we connect and disconnect with each other. So it's definitely present and prevalent within us. And it's genetically coded and needs to be treated because we're all equal. You know, we're like shades of the rainbow in the African, you know, American race. We come in different colors, different shapes and sizes. Nevertheless, we all represent the ethics and the essence of the motherland.
Yeah, and of course, Abby was talking about the Willie Lynch letter and the making of a slave, and it starts out by saying, "Gentlemen, I greet you here on the banks of the James River in our year of the Lord 1000," and it talks about the making of a slave and how you break a man down and how you build him back up and make him more docile. That's what Abby was referring to. So, Jim, I want to also talk a little bit about Dr. King's speech. He says, 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. Now, Jimmy, you talked a little bit a few minutes ago about the poverty and jobless. How are we doing on this island of poverty is my question to you. And should I say, are we putting holes in our own boats so we can't get off that island?
Well, yes. The short answer to that is yes. We are putting holes in our own boat. But most importantly of that is that those that have had opportunity have not always taken the opportunity, for one, to get off the island. Some people have found to be okay living like they're living. When you look back in time and you look back over years and see how people of color have lived, when you go back to the Delta down in Mississippi and you go back to, you look at that area and you look at how people live, you're like, how could they live like that in America? And here we are today, and you still have people that live just like that in America, in a place that's supposed to be the richest country of them all. So what is that? You know, what is that about poverty? Yes, I know that there will always be poor among us, but poor doesn't always mean you don't have, you know, in terms of something to eat. We have literally millions of people every day that go hungry. You know, the new statistic came out just this week about 1 in 4 children every single day go hungry. That is a sin and a shame in a country that is supposed to be the richest of them all. Now, are there some circumstances to that? Of course, in terms of how we live and what we spend our money on, what we find to be valuable. Because instead of buying the cigarettes and the cable and the phones and the Gucci and the Prada, you ought to be putting some food in your house, of course. But for those situations where you are working 3 jobs to make ends meet and you are doing everything you can possibly do to provide for your family, this should be a country that should help you do that. It should not turn you away if you make $10 more than what the cutoff is. It shouldn't do that. It should, the system shouldn't be so harsh that it turns away and then the children suffer. So, you know, the nation is in such disarray, and unfortunately the Negro is still on this island, you know, not being completely taken care of and not completely taking care of himself.
Now, Jima, would you say that the welfare legislation enabled those people to get to that island?
Well, I think he had a good intention, talking about President Clinton, in terms of how to do something different, but it didn't go far enough. There's so many things that people in positions and our legislators that they put forth and they vote on and they pass it, and it doesn't go far enough. That didn't go far enough because it did not take the family out of a situation. It just gave them a way to maintain through. And then once their time was up on the books, They back to not having nothing. So, you know, where was the part about some training, some job training to make sure that they were going to be able to maintain a job when they got out? Not just job training on what to do, but how to do, how to be to work on time, how many buses you going to have to take to get from point A to point B if you want this job, if you don't have transportation. It didn't go far enough, and thus we have, you know, the roles were full of people that accepted welfare.
Well, so Abby, how does one interpret then Dr. King's comment about the Long Island poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity? So I heard a comment of a legislator say talk about how many poor people, I'm gonna put that in quotes, have big screen TVs. How many poor people are buying the latest in gadgets and widgets? So how do you interpret what he says?
You know something, it reflects the same ideologies as you just stated. People, you know, and this is a sad thing to say because I was on a committee that steered the Department of Social Services back in 1994 when it became Family Independence Agency. Now we're called the Department of Human Services. Whatever state you're in, it's still the same thing. It's still the social service or welfare system. What happened was that they did not give the essential skills and the empowerment to people who were on the system. I know, like Jima said, President Clinton did the best that he could, but something happened. There was a disconnect, however, when the federal government turned the powers that be over to the states, and the majority of the state leaders, which were governors, were Republican, and they broke the program down. What they did, first of all, they destroyed what was called the General Assistance Program. Now, what we did the research and the analysis. They did have the program. It's called now Refugee Assistance, and it's only given to people who are considered as immigrants to this country. So, meanwhile, I'm just trying to synopsize it as quickly as I can. What happened was that they did not teach them the ethics of life skills, because I'm not saying that the people that are on the system are illiterate or incapable of comprehending what is sensible and not sensible, but nevertheless they need a little bit better support as it relates to setting priorities, what you must have, what you say you need, and what you want, and giving them those three categories and specifically identifying them. There's three levels of existence. The biological, you have to have food, shelter, clothing, a safe place to live, utilities, you have to be in a good, wholesome environment. Second level is the psychological level. You have to have a strong sense of self, self-esteem, self-worth, integrity, intelligence, the ability to master base level and competitive skills. The third level was socializing. You got to get out there and network in order to increase your network. So there was a disconnect in between those three levels being implemented within that program. And as a result, many people, you know, and I hate to be so blunt because as an educator, I see it every day. These women started, I mean, women as young as 17, 18 all the way up to 50-something without having babies as a way of providing income in a household to get extra food stamps on their grant. Because why? They had not learned about setting priorities, what is essential, what may seem essential, and what totally isn't. And they did not get that trained. So when you don't have the networking skills, the capacity of the training, the ability to make sound and, you know, and resolvable decisions, you're going to have an aftermath of total destruction. And now we've got to the point here in the state of Michigan, because the destruction was so intense and immense, there's a 4-year cap on anybody who's receiving social benefits by the way of a family grant for dependent children or even those who are translating to go into the Work First program. They have 4 years, 48 months. After that, they're going to be cut off. And of what the latest statistics indicated, there in this area alone will be 11,000 people cut off the system as of October the 1st. So, see, the disconnect is still continuing. And with all of this wealth that's in this country and all the things that we have to offer, the system, and I definitely criticize them here and now, you're still not networking. You're still not creating the formidable basis to teach these people true ethics of life skills. If they have some degree of limitation, you're supposed to address that limitation, not increase the grant amount, but show them how how to utilize effective money management, show them how to sell themselves to the employer. What are the connectivity components? They go through work first, a year and a half, and after that you have to go and find some type of job. You may went under clerical training under work first, but you've got to find a job, even if it's in a local restaurant down the street or around the corner. Where's the connectivity pieces? You know, they needed to have been in a more structured setting where they could really connect with career-based employers to get these people out and to get them, make them job-ready, make them job-appropriate, and help them to utilize their own empowerment skills. And the disconnect is still happening, and it's really going to hit hard. It's October 1st this year.
Okay. So obviously we've taken a look at Dr. King's speech on the March on Washington for Jobs. And we kind of taken apart the beginning of the speech. I want to shift for a moment of the towards the unveiling of the memorial, right? Because, you know, although this is in observance of the 48th anniversary of it, they also erected a memorial this week, and it was going to be open to the public, but of course the weather kind of prevented this activity from taking place. Now, I must say that nothing that African Americans do comes without controversy. So although we're trying to celebrate a marvelous human being and all of the wonderful things that he has accomplished and he has provided for our American society, there was a controversial issue related to the memorial itself. Now, it's around the person that actually built the memorial. Now, I'm not sure if a lot of people know about this, but a Chinese sculptor was used in the construction of the memorial. Now, also academics, union members, and others were angered by the decision to bring a group of Chinese workers to Washington to put the statue together. So that means it was not one American. For that matter, it was not one African American that could have done the job. So, Jima, my question is to you. Should we be outraged that an American, or specifically an African American, was not the lead of this project worth millions of dollars?
Well, I think it kind of goes back to what our caller last week mentioned when he was talking about the CBC in terms of they just a bunch of Johnny-come-latelys. Well, it's the same situation. It's built now. The outrage should have been when it was first developed. The outrage should have been when it was first determined who the architect of it was going to be. Not now. The unveiling is here now. Let's not rain on, you know, the moment. You know, the outrage should have happened when it was discovered that the person that was given the undaunting task of building and erecting and designing this monument, A, was not American, and B, was Chinese, from China, wherever you're from. So that's when the outrage could have happened. And I remember a little bit of it because I'm just kind of tuned in like that, but I don't remember as much as I've heard this week about it. So, you know, all of this is too late. We should have had this conversation however long it's taken them to build it, 10 years now or something, however long it's taken for all of it to come together, all the money to be raised. Where is the outrage on the amount of money? Where is the outrage that people have not donated to this and that it's taken corporations, the same groups that we say we want to boycott, but had it not been for these corporations donating money to this cause, it still wouldn't be done because we've not donated nothing. I don't recall anybody having a fundraiser for the MLK Memorial.
Interesting.
You know, so the outrage should have happened, you know, when 5 years ago, not now. It's too late now. Go up there, take a picture of the monument, smile, and keep it moving. It's too late.
Right. So, Jima, do you think China would have an African-American or a person from America come to China to build a statue for their revered individuals?
I can't speculate on what China would do. My issue is the same. If we had this much concern about it, if we were that concerned about a person of color, or black architect firm or whomever, a black sculptor, some masons, whatever we wanted, then we should have been louder in the beginning. Our voices should have been heard. Should have been heard in the beginning. We should have come to the table with a plan. Whoever these black architects firms out there now that want to have something to say about it, where were you in the beginning? And I'm not saying they wasn't there. I'm not saying that. But the you know they maybe they just needed to be a little bit louder and a little bit more persistent. And letting people know, hey, we can do this. We don't need to go out of the country and spend, you know, quadruple the amount we would spend because I heard somewhere one guy say a lot of the marble was going to be donated. It was going to be free, so it wouldn't have even cost them anything. So all of that very well may be true. I'm not discounting any of it. I don't know what China would do. Probably not, but here we sit. You know, that's what we do. We Johnny come lately, and now we want to be mad about the monument. Because of who built it, or and even when the drawings were being put together, people were talking about that the posture that King was in was one of confrontation because he had his arms folded. Well, you know, I could go on the other side of that and say that Reverend King was confrontational. Anytime you stand up in the face of injustice and you stand up and say, I'm going to go march with some sanitation workers, anytime you stand up and say anytime you sit down and say we're not getting up, you're confrontational. Anytime you lead a massive movement like he did in Selma with and Montgomery, you're confrontational. Whether or not you want to call it that, that's fine. But he was pretty confrontational because he called things out as he saw them. So, you know, whether or not China would do it, I don't know, but we should have been a little bit louder. Those of us that have some issues or concerns with it should have been a little bit louder back when everything was being planned. Because you got to remember, so this is the issue with us and our community at times. We'll have a notion about something, but at the end of the day, we don't stand around long enough to see how it ends up. And there are some that don't even think a monument should be there. Dr. King wouldn't want a monument. You know, he'd want a revolution. Really? And so define revolution to me. Define how you can be a part of the revolution as opposed to what Dr. King would want. What you want? So we have to take into account all of those things and realize that we came up short once again, but it's too late now to talk about it. He's there. And he's who's coming to dinner. So let's welcome him at the table.
Well, speaking of confrontational, Dr. Boyce Watkins wrote an article that I thought was very confrontational. And the article is entitled, Why I Won't Be Attending the MLK Memorial Dedication Ceremony. Now, in the article he writes, as the date for the Martin Luther King Memorial Dedication approaches, I am finding ways to convince myself that I should be excited and inspired. I think about the extraordinary life of the man whose speeches my mother made me recite when I was 12, and how Dr. King's intellect was accompanied by the courage and action necessary to impact a nation. Although I wouldn't dare compare myself with this amazing man, I can say that Dr. King's commitment to putting his academic and spiritual retraining to work for the masses serves as a perpetual model for nearly everything I do each day. But there's another part of me that becomes saddened and even disgusted by our decision to celebrate Dr. King's life in a way that would probably insult him. Economic inequality has actually worsened over time, and the very politicians who claim to admire the life of Dr. King are quite to urinate on the ideas of which he stood. In fact, I venture to say that if he were alive, Martin Luther King would not attend this ceremony himself. As it stands today, black male unemployment is now over 40% in many urban areas. African Americans are being incarcerated at Holocaust proportions, and inner city children are leaving school without even learning how to read. The word poverty is rarely mentioned in Washington, and America has become a hyper-militarized international bully, all in the name of corporate profitability. Jima, isn't there a lot of truth to his comments?
Yeah, there's some truth to his comments, but I go back to the you know, personal responsibility of it all. And as much as we want to blame the outside for our economic conditions, some of it is self-inflicted because of our lifestyle that we've grown accustomed to for whatever reason. So yes, I can't say I don't agree with him, but I have to also look at it from the other standpoint of some of the ills that are facing our communities and some of the people. He's right that they stand and they take their liberties on some of the things that he stood for. I agree with that as well. But then we haven't held those same people accountable. We haven't made them take a serious about a cause. Excuse me, because we can't agree on a cause. So who's really that concerned about addressing something in the black community when we haven't agreed on what there is to address in the black community? Now, to say that, they didn't agree back when King was around either. And so, once again, we create this romantic idea of black life back in the day as though everybody was marching to the same beat, and they were not. But they were getting things done in whatever beat they was marching. Therein is the problem with us today. Not only are we not in step with one another, but we're not getting too much done either. At least those different groups was getting things done, and that's not what we're doing. So we have some culpability and some of the things that he's talked about. But on the other side, you know, those systems, going back to Dr. King's speech, America has failed. America has sent us back a check. It's insufficient. You can't deny that. We did not get what you said you was going to give me. And I think I said this last week. I wouldn't keep asking you for my $5 if you never said you was going to give me $5. So America should have never said that you was going to treat me like a human and I was going to have these rights to be able to pursue happiness and that you were going to provide for me. If you were never going to do those things, then America should have never said it, because then I would not be expecting it. So, you know, it's twofold.
So let me get the Motor City Maharani to weigh in on this. Now, Dr. Boyce Watkins says that he don't think he should attend the memorial because poverty is way up. Male unemployment is now over 40% in many urban areas. Now, Abby, would you not attend the unveiling of this monumental occasion just because we haven't made great strides in these issues?
I would still attend the ceremony. Excuses, excuses, excuses. Why? Because you know what? We always want to find an innuendo, an alibi for irresponsibility. If you simply don't want to go to the unveiling of the memorial, just say you don't want to go. You know something? You know what I'm saying? Just be real. Countermeasuring the occasion because of your disharmonies. That's just like me saying, I'm not going to work tomorrow with DPS, in which I have to go because some of my coworkers are still laid off. Yeah, they're laid off. I'm fighting to get that job back. But, hell, I'm going to make my impact by showing up tomorrow. So you don't make change by sitting up complaining. What's wrong? Get out there. Be a bigger part of the answer as opposed to a bigger part of the issue itself. And sitting back and not attending, you're doing just what the Anglo-Saxon psychosis it constitutes to the fact that we as a nation of people are so divided, carried away by charismatic overtures of materialism, self-inflicted idealism, and self-made agendas, that we can't even come together as one. As the Jews come together in their celebration of a Holocaust, what happened to them on World War II, many of them are different belief persuasions, many of them are different economic levels, but those people come together at that particular time and on that particular day. Why can't we do it? We're so busy talking each other down, walking each other down, tearing each other down. We don't have common sense to even tie shoestrings straight. So he can take that excuse, as far as I'm concerned, and take it to the bank. cash in on it, and they'll turn around and have him escorted out the door. That's a poor reason not to attend. And as it relates to you was talking about how the sculpture was made and all that, that's irrelevant. Like Gina said, and I say this too, you idiots, you need to discuss that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years ago. Nobody probably even constituted a mannerism in which they were accrued, you know, contractors to even do the project. What was the process like? You know, was there any bids that were given? You know, was there a particular itinerary or characteristics in which, you know, the company would have had to ascertain in order to qualify to do this project? It's a lot of logistics in there. Nobody even considered looking at the logistics. They don't care. Now, all of a sudden, like you said, it's made, created, and ready to be viewed by the public. It's an issue. Too much complaining. Turn around, be a bigger part of the solution as opposed to a greater part of the problem. Change your mind.
Okay. Well said, Abby. So, Jim, let me ask you this question. You mentioned this, and I want to kind of maybe take it one step further. You said that, you know, back then, and people wanted to romanticize the fact that, you know, how the situations were back then. Well, if you look at the controversial, the opposition of King and the gesture of Malcolm X, they both were kind of had opposing views, if you will. And so, and I think they both have a monumental part of our American history. So my question to you, Jima, should Malcolm X have a statue just like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.?
Well, you have to look at in the totality of his body of work. Will it be in Washington on the Potomac River? Probably not. But can he, which this isn't the first monument to Martin Luther King, let's be clear about that. He has several statues of him in different cities all around the country. And I'm sure Malcolm has one a couple of places as well. So it's not as though he doesn't have a statue. But will he have one there? Probably not. That's just probably not.
So, Abby, what do you make of the fact that Martin Luther King's statue is bigger than everybody else's in Washington?
We know something. This man made a monumental impact, not just in the African American race, Patrick, but in all races, because many of his ethics, his practices, relate back to Mahatma Gandhi, who was definitely one of his great mentors. So I think that this replicates to the fact this man helped to change the face not only of the African American nation, but the nation of which we all reside here in America. All across the world, they had the highest degree of reverence and respect for this man because he, you know, he didn't, you know, put any barriers in between the colors of people. He was for all people, and that equality must be ascribed to not only here in the continental United States of America, but all around the world. So, yes, I believe that he is deserving of that honor and of that respect because his legacy is yet apparent and evident within each and every one of us. Whether we live up to the expectation of the dream or not, that seed was planted. It's up to us to water it, nurture it, and let it grow. And a lot of people were just impacted by this man, yes.
Wow, well said. Now, on just the other side of the break, we're going to be talking about a Tea Partier's comments to throw the president and the first lady out of a helicopter. If you haven't heard this, wait until you hear what she said. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for a discounted book for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. I want to shift gears for a minute to this Tea Partier whose name is Sherry Lansford Smith. Now, most would say that what makes Smith's joke into an issue is that President Obama and his family are constantly receiving death threats, more than any president in the history of the United States. Also, some attribute the death threats to be driven by negative energy being created by the Tea Party. Now, listen to what she said. Now, this was posted on her Facebook page, and she wanted other people to pass it on. Now, here's what she said. Obama looked at Michelle, chuckled, and said, "You know, I could throw $1,000 bill out of the window right now and make somebody very happy." Michelle shrugged her shoulders and replied, "I could throw 10 $100 bills out of the window and make 10 people very happy." Hearing their exchange, the pilot of the plane said to his co-pilot, "Such big shots back there. I could throw both of them out of the window and make 256 million people very happy. If you're one of the 250 million, pass it on." Now, Jima, isn't this just another case of someone exercising their First Amendment rights?
It would be if it wasn't against the President of the United States. Now, my issue, I mean, if it was, you know, it wouldn't be. I mean, there's certain things that you're not allowed to say, even in jest, as it relates to the President. And we all know that. But here's the thing. Where is the outcry? Where is the outrage from the media, from the community, about this woman making these statements? Where's the outcry? I don't even know if you heard it on mainstream media, you know, about this. And yet, you know, and this has been going on since the beginning of his presidency. Even before he was president, there's been all sorts of things, and nobody wants to talk about it because nobody wants to say it's because he's black. But it is because he's black. We keep looking at the elephant in the middle of the room and don't want to call the elephant. And so there's no other reason that this person would make this comment, because I've never heard this comment from anybody other president. I've never heard such anger and venom and hostility towards a president. Even Bush, when he stole the election from Gore, did not get all of this. He didn't.
Nope.
You can't tell me he did. People just kind of laid down, was like, "Oh well, okay." Everybody know he stole it, but there was no outcry, no continual outcry. Nobody stood up on George Bush when he did his State of the Union and called him a lie or called him a fake. Nobody did that on the floor to him. So, you know, you can't tell me that the elephant in the room is not about the president being African-American. I'm sorry, being Negro, being colored, being black, being Afro-American, all of them. You can't tell me that it's not related to that. My mind.
What do you think? What do you think? I mean, is this just someone making a joke and we being too insensitive or what?
No, we're not. We're not being sensitive enough, because you know what? With that, I hate to be so blunt, but I got to take it back. When George W. Bush was on the airplane less than 3 years before this nation got attacked, with the very man who he claimed was the assailant. And in the, all these thousands of lives, 3,300 lives were taken right at ground zero by itself. When this man lied and said that Saddam Hussein was the engineering mechanism, the brilliant mindset behind the attack, and lied his way into Iraq to steal Iraqi oil and push this nation to a war of no end, of no resolve, did nobody get on Facebook? Did nobody go on Twitter? Did nobody go on MySpace and bash George W. Bush? It's not about the fact of President Obama just merely being the president of his age and of his background and his family's educational level. It's about the fact that the man is black. Had he done what George W. Bush done, trust me, just like they had the Nuremberg trials to test and try those Nazi war criminals from World War II, they would have had the Afrocentric version of the Nuremberg trials and would have had President Barack Obama's head on a silver platter delivered to the white racist society of America, the Blue Dogs and all the rest of those underlying schemers and backstabbers. They would have ordered that man to be executed. But what did we do with George W. Bush? He's coming back on to talk about the recap of 9/11 when he had his sick, sorry self down there in Florida reading to children as his very country that he was supposed to have been the leader of was literally being attacked from all perspective sides. So, yes, it's all about the color issue. They still have not matured to the fact that this is a black man that's the president, and I hope to God, and we're going to make sure he wins by a landslide. These colors don't run. We're the one that turn around and causes the sun to shine, and we're going to prove it.
So if the situation was reversed, Jima, if the president was white and the culprit was black, what would you think would be the response?
Okay, let's just look at what happened with Kanye West. When
okay.
he got on TV and said George Bush didn't care about black people.
Right.
What happened to Kanye West?
He was on the Today Show. He was asked to apologize. He was taking,
yep.
I mean. It,
right. His career took a nosedive for a minute. They blackballed him, you know, for a minute.
Yep.
You know, he had to,
yep.
he really had to step back and
mm-hmm.
be put, quote unquote, in his place. Because how dare
mm-hmm.
he get on TV and say anything about the president of the United States? You
right.
understand what I'm saying? So here, that is the best example I can give you is to tell you what happened to Kanye West. It's right there.
That's it.
So what happens to if a black person had done it? We'll have to do a what if. We'll have to do we got proof what happens if a black person get on TV and say something about the president. We have proof.
That's right.
So
that's
you
right.
know this isn't a theory. This one this is practical. We already see the end result on this. Yeah.
Okay. So speaking of swapping places, I want to shift now to the whole Michael Vick issue. Now, ESPN wrote an article, and in the article, Turay wrote an article for ESPN. And just like when you write in your blogs, or just like when you write in your articles, you want to find a picture or a pictorial representation of what you're writing about. And so in this particular instance, ESPN took the liberty to take the article and massage a picture that would really shape to what the article was talking about. Specifically, what they did was they took the picture, a picture of Michael Vick, and they photoshopped it. They made Michael Vick look white. And so, of course, there was a crazy outrage about it. But I want you to hear both sides of the argument for the particular stories. I want you to take a listen to this, and we're going to talk about this.
Against an image ESPN published on its website, it ran a Photoshop picture of Eagles quarterback Michael Vick as a white man. Here it is. It was meant to accompany an article which ESPN titled, "What If Michael Vick Were White?" The author of that article says he had no idea about the artwork and wants to be judged on the words in his article. His name is Turay. Maybe you remember him. He was part of the American Morning family. And it's safe to say he is not happy with the headline or the picture. Turay tweeted this last night. He said, "I wrote an essay about Vick and race. ESPN, the magazine, titled it and added the art without me, which is normal procedure. Judge me on the story, not the art." ESPN, though, stands by its decision, saying it appreciates appreciates and encourages the discussion the image has prompted. Joining us now is Teray, who is the author of Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? We're also joined by Raina Kelly, the senior editor of ESPN, the magazine. Welcome to you both. When you saw this image of Michael Vick as a white man, your thoughts were?
I was dismayed. I was horrified. I didn't imagine that they would do that. And it contradicts what I'm doing in the story, because I talk about that. There's this commonplace idea, this thought experiment that all of us do, that if something happens to somebody, white or black, and you say, well, just switch their races, and then would it be racist or not racist? And this is so supposedly a test to know, is it racist or not? Would the same thing happen if you person was black or white? And I'm like, this whole concept doesn't really make any sense, because race informs your entire life. So you wouldn't even enter the same moment the same way, right? You'd be entirely different. If Michael Vick were white, if that was even imaginable, he may not even go to the NFL because he might see other options for his life and would try to do something else with his life. So just the concept of reimagining somebody as white or black is extraordinarily difficult. And I dismiss the concept of that right away in the story. So for the headline and the image to suggest let's look at him as white is extremely – it's a perpendicular relationship to the story that I wrote.
Okay. Well, let's head to Raina then. So Raina, why – because you had a part in the decision-making. Why put this image out there? Like, why make Michael Vick a white man?
Okay. Well, the first reason we did it is because – I mean, I'm sure as you know, the purpose of the art in a magazine, on television, in a newspaper, is to accompany and make the reader think in a way similar to the story. We knew this picture was going to be provocative. We knew it was going to be thought-provoking. That is what we wanted. We did not want people to shut down. We wanted people to stop, look at the picture, and then read the article, which in fact is what they did. It's a fantastic article. And one in which Teray, as he mentioned, handles race in a very nuanced and layered way. Mm-hmm. But the first question, which is asked and answered in the piece, is would this happen to a white quarterback? Teray says yes. And then we move on to the idea of switching races. And that is something that's very interesting to me and I think to our readers, because when you look at somebody and you look at their race, you make decisions about them immediately. And what we wanted to do was almost a visual experiment with our readers. How do you feel about Michael Vick when you see him white?
Okay. So, Dima, let me ask you that question. How do you feel when you've seen the article and you notice that Michael Vick was white?
Well, it's two things. One, of course, you know, marketing is everything. And they're probably going to get an increase in spike in sales of ESPN magazine simply because of this article, okay? And a spike in hits on the website simply because of this article. Because you can't have a picture of someone who is as dark as Michael Vick and make him white, which he really doesn't look white on here. He really looks like a light-skinned dude, but anyway, that's beside the point. I digress. But anyway, so you get everybody's attention with the title, What If Michael Vick Was White? Well, we've already had that conversation. We've already had that conversation that we know without a shadow of a doubt, if Michael Vick was white and he was in that whole dog fighting thing, he would not have gotten 2 years in prison, almost 2 years in prison. We've already had that conversation about if he was. And the sad part about it is we haven't just had that about Michael Vick in terms of athletes. We've had about a whole bunch of them. If this was, we go back to being Roethlisberger for Pittsburgh, that he was given some different avenues when his case came up as opposed to somebody else who had, you know, as opposed to Michael Irvin. You know, we know the differences is race. It's not ability. It's not the team they play on. It was race, plain and simple. And yet again, that's the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about and nobody wants to admit. But, yeah, we know that if he wasn't a dark-skinned brother from Virginia, that he wouldn't have gone through all the situations he's gone through. And Torrey wrote, and it's an excellent article. So kudos to him. Because he did write an excellent article, you know. It's just unfortunate that it's being clouded by this perceived controversy that we've had this conversation in the barbershops and beauty shops all along about, we know for sure if Michael Vick was white, he wouldn't have had to go through all the things that he had to go through.
So, Abby, what do you make of the fact that Toure seemed to suggest that if you do swap the races out of the individuals, that it wouldn't matter? That the fact that, because if he was a white person, he would have came up, he would have had a set of different circumstances, and that, you know, he may have made different choices. But most of the time when we have that conversation, we don't talk about, you know, what if somebody was white and they lived their life as being white. We talk about the moment in time.
Yeah.
As opposed to that person being switching out lives. So
right.
To me, Toure was trying to take us somewhere that when we talk about switching races to get up to measure what would happen with each other, that we don't typically go. What are your thoughts about that?
I agree. You know, there's one phase of scrutiny for the whites, and there's another separate category for the blacks. If you're white, you get criticized, okay? After your criticism goes, they pat you on the back, take the handcuffs off, you're free to go. But lo and behold, if you're black, you get criticized, ostracized, demoralized, and even crucified. Good example of this incident, look at the previous mayor, Kwame M. Kilpatrick. I love to use him as an example. Kwame M. Kilpatrick was one of the most brilliant young black brothers in the face of this nation, not in the city of Detroit, in the state of Michigan, the face of the nation. Yes, he was young when he took office. Yes, he was a little undomiciled. Yes, he was a little wild and loose, and he was a hip-hop mayor. We know that, but this guy has some strong credibilities. He was an attorney and previously an educator. He made some very bad decisions that relate to his moral characteristics and behavior. Yes, he did. And as a result, he was scrutinized. You know, he was ostracized, criticized, and even crucified. All the major networks had their eyes on the city of Detroit, on one person, with Monica Conyers and with Art Blackwell and with Sam Riddle and all these other people. Yeah, they talked about them, but they crucified Kwame M. Kilpatrick. Here was the president, Bill Clinton, who had an affair with Monica Lewinsky. Literally, everybody knew that he did. And the first thing that he said was that I never touched that woman. Well, when somebody gives you oral gratification, they're still touching you if it's not intermediately so with the hand or whatever have you, or other manual operatives. They yet had contact with you. What did America do? Oh, that was a shame. She's so nasty. That's all they said. And talked it down and casted it out. Now, this man didn't do half as much and didn't have half as the posture as the president. They crucified him, but nevertheless, now, even though he's not in the arena of politics, he's making more money as a motivational speaker and a professor and a presenter than all of the presidents combined. So where is the justice? Where is the peripheral? Where is the outline between the two variables? There's one set for the whites and another set for the blacks, and blacks fall down under every time. But what really hurts me is the fact when we jump on the anti-black bandwagon, it helped to crucify them the more. That's what irates me.
Interesting. Well, I want to talk about another football player, and this guy, we're going to shift from Michael Vick to Cam Newton for a second. Now, I don't know if you heard this, but in the news, during a recent interview with Charlie Rose, Carolina Panthers owner Jerry Richardson described his pre-NFL draft meeting with Cam Newton. Now, here's what he said. He was dressed perfectly, Richardson told Rose. I said, do you have any tattoos? Cam Newton said, no, sir, I don't have any. I said, do you have any piercing? Cam Newton said, no, sir. And then Richardson said, we want to keep it that way. Now, Jima, what do you make of a coach telling a football player that they can't have any tattoos or piercing?
Well, he didn't say he couldn't. He said, we would like to keep it that way. So you can infer that that's kind of, you know, a strong suggestion that he not get any. Well, he's lived this long without them. I don't think that that's too big of a stretch. Now, the flip side of that is, if he chose to get it, and there's no, which I doubt he could put a clause in his contract that's not in anybody else's, then the owner is really just making a strong suggestion. But it's the fact that he thought it was okay to make that suggestion. That's the problem. They have this air of entitlement of being over everybody and owning everybody. You're on a team, and I work for you, and I have to abide by certain rules and guidelines, but those rules and guidelines are not specific to me. They're specific to the team. So if you haven't made this this suggestion strongly to every other member on the team, to the other 56 players that are going to be on this team, then it's just a suggestion. And I go out and do what I really want to do, and he'll have to deal with it. And I can get a tattoo in many places that never be seen. So the fact that, you know, he said it and said it out loud where he thought it was okay to say, that's what's causing the problem, because he really can't control him like that.
But Abby, what do you think? Why would he even make that suggestion?
Right. I don't understand that, because if you were to feel that way, that's your personal referendum. You keep that to yourself. And if you want to make that statement, don't just single out a specific individual. Make it collectively to the entire team. Other than that, keep your mouth shut. Do your job as what you're being hired to do. Let a person make their own rightful referendum of their choices upon their own delegation. If it does not affect his level of performance, it does not slow him down in the way that he's carrying out and taking care of his business, what does it matter to you whether or not he gets tattoos and piercing? That's a personal referendum. It's not your business as a manager.
I have a problem with the statement only because of the paperwork or on the business transaction that take place in these type of activities. You know, Cam Newton has an agent. An agent goes in, they make a deal, they sign a contract with money involved in it. The team have policies. Most of the people are involved in learning these policies. They have a playbook. They have to study these playbooks. Mm-hmm. They have all of these rules and regulations that that govern the team and its members. And so for a coach or an owner to come in and say this to an individual as opposed to a team gathering, I have a problem with it. I have a problem with it because he's almost saying that you know, I own you.
Belong to me.
And I own
That's
your
funny.
Body. This is kind of familiar.
Thank you.
When you have a person.
To me.
Exactly.
That's right.
That's what it looks very familiar to, a process back way in the 18th century when you have a person, they come in, you put them on a pedestal, you look at their teeth, you have them run, you have them jump, you stretch their arms out,
mm-hmm.
you have them, you know,
mm-hmm.
jump up and down, and then you pick
yes.
the ones that you want. Now, I'm
yes.
not saying that's what this is, but I'm saying is it sounds very familiar to me when
yeah.
you go out on a limb and you say that to an individual as opposed
mm-hmm.
to a team, and you already have vehicles in place to make
uh-huh.
these decisions for a team.
That's
so that's all I have to say. But, you know, who knows? I can't really say, you know, for his state of mind, but I tell you that it was very disturbing to see that
yes.
that a owner would talk to
right.
a player in that fashion. Now, the final story I want to talk about today is, and I even hate to bring it up sometime, but Bishop Eddie Long is back in the news. Now, this story will not go away. Now, Jimmy, you blogged about this earlier, and you said that these young men are willing to give up $20 million to get their story out. Now, of course, this is unbelievable. Most people would take the money and run. This speaks to them not just being in it for the money. Now, Eddie Long's two other accusers came forward to talk about what happened to them and tell why they were speaking up now. Now, last week, Centrino came forward to talk about the abuse at Long's hands. Now, Jamal Parris and Spencer LeGrande talked up to a local CBS TV to say that they knew they were risking their money they received by sitting down to do this interview. When we come back from the break, I am going to play some of the interview and let you hear them talk about the events that took place with Bishop Eddie Long. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. We'll be back in a moment. Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for a discounted book for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Once again, I want to talk about Bishop. Now, I hate bringing him up, but I think it's important for people to get the information that's out there, right? And so, you know, it's unfortunate that he keeps coming up, but as long as he does, we got to make sure that we keep people informed. And so I want to play an interview of two of the accusers, and I'm going to play it for just a few minutes. I want you to listen in, and I want you to listen to the passion and to the details and to the descriptions that they give, and then we're going to talk about it, and I'll take your comments. Listen.
Where did all this, how did it all begin?
I was 14 when I moved to Atlanta. Take my number down. Call me. Me, I'm 14 years old. I'm new to the state. I can't. Like, what do we got to talk about? We're not even in the same league. When I got in trouble at school, I called him, and the next day, my mom came, picked me up. And the teacher was actually saying, can I keep my job? I apologize. And that's how I actually got caught up into it. Like, that's how I became, let me just do everything the church do. Let me do everything he say do, because I want to be like that. You got that much power. I'm listening to rappers call, say, can I rent your car? Can I borrow money from you? Because my next thing will come out, I need an event. So you hear this, and you see these people around them. When I said in my first interview, it's a drug. It literally is. You're 14 years old. You don't see this stuff often. And I get the chance to be with you and just run with you just because? It's the power that he commanded when he walked into a room. That's dad. To everybody. You walk in the sermon. Hey, Pops. You go into the office. Hey, Pops. You walk around the city. Hey, Pop. But yet he'll make sure when I walk in the city, this is my son. We're going places. I'm with the president. This is my son. I felt bad for his kids. Man, I don't know what y'all doing at home, but this my dad now. That's tough.
How did he transition it? How did it progress?
You're just so comfortable. And then out of nowhere, he just hits you with the most emotional question. Now, when he takes you to that emotional question, I'm taking you back to a memory. It's almost like hypnotism. Relax, lay down. Talk about how you feel. And then you start vividly thinking about it. And you start crying. And that's when I talk to you. I know what you're feeling. And I know what it's like. And I'm sorry. And I'm going to step in the place of your father. And I'm not going to let you go. Wow, for real? You going to do all that? That's what's up. You're my dad. So while everybody sees a well-dressed grown man, they don't know you treat me like a, and I grow up with that mentality, regardless of what you think my age is, regardless of whether you think it's right, I'm 7 years old in my own eyes.
At the moment, as a 14-year-old, you're thinking like you're the luckiest kid in the world. It's like,
you know, nothing can touch you. Like, you know, you always know somebody got your back, you know. And for me, it was more of a spiritual connection with them. You know, it was all about God. The day that I met him, you know, it was just, you know, it was just like a God moment, you know. It was, you know, the most emotional point in my life that I've ever been. Like, actually, the day that I met him, he actually had a sermon about forgiving your father, about all the stuff that, you know, he did in the past. I thought, you know, this is just a God connection. Like, this is my purpose to be a part of this church. Cause I changed my whole life because of what he told me. You know, I used to play basketball. I used to be a sport. I used to play quarterback. I was a point guard. I was a power forward, whatever. I was real skilled in basketball.
He taught me how to play chess, and I don't even like the game. I just learned how to think beyond what other people think. It's a perfect way. A predator, it's, they have a certain pattern that they all do. And for him, it started, let me captivate you. You want to get a pretty girl? Show a pretty ring. Show a pretty watch. Show a pretty necklace. Show a pretty car. Got your attention. Okay, now that I got your attention, let me talk to you. Let me friend you. Let me show you what I really can do. Now I'll show you who I am is powerful. Okay, now let me befriend you. Let me get you to confide in me. Talk to me. Now I know your secrets. I got your attention. You know I'm powerful. And I got your secrets. I rule you.
So, that was a lot coming from these two young men that they that what I got out of it is that they thought he was playing mind games with them, or he was, you know, trying to get into their mind. What do you think, Jima?
Yeah, because once he gets into the mind, if what they're saying is true, and as the last guy said in the interview, it's easier to manipulate you. Because now I know your vulnerabilities, I know your weaknesses, because you've shared so much with me, and I can begin to use those against you, not where you know that I'm using them against you, but you'll begin to feel more indebted to me because I've given you something that you've never had before. And so that's how it starts. It starts that way. And that's what they're saying, is that that's how it started. It was innocent. He was a father figure to them. They trusted him. They told him everything. He showed them things they'd never seen before. And so they felt probably at the end of the day, when all the story comes out, a certain sense of they felt indebted to him, and they felt like that they had to do what he said because of all he had done for them.
Hmm. Abby, what do you think the motivation of the bishop, if these you know, allegations are true, what do you think his motivation was?
Control, manipulation, and power. And apparently, you know, he was using these very young men because, see, when they're in that phase of their life as adolescents, they're very impressionable. You know, the majority of these young men, I'm sure, came from households that there was not a father or a male, strong male presence within the environment. So these young men were desperate. They were seeking. They were longing for that presence. And he provided them with that presence. First of all, he gave them an impressionable dexterity of his character, that he was caring, he was nurturing, that he held their best interests in mind. So if you can manipulate a person, especially when they're young, they're highly impressionable, and they're desperate for that strong male presence in their life because they don't know anything about true male bonding, when you get them into that particular mindset or that fragment of thinking, it's no problem to get into their thoughts by the power of suggestion. You know, you're asking them, you know, general questions, and then whatever they say, you respond by explaining a little bit more. And yeah, how did you know that? How did you know that? Your favorite color is blue. Well, you got on all blue. But see, to them, this is something that's super and phenomenal. And once he got the trust of them and got into their level of psychological awareness or their level of thinking capacity, it was no problem for them to manipulate them physically. That's right, because that's where it all started. And then, you know, a little touch or a feel, you know, they might think, oh, he's just trying to show me love by hugging me, by touching my genitals. And then the next thing you know, one thing leads to another. And there you have it right there, that they've been molested by this malevolent individual that gives all you know, leaders within the capacity of very, very unscrupulous reputation and name, you know, and it's sad. You know, we had enough of from it from the Catholic persuasion. Now we're seeing a man that says he's a charismatic Christian conducting himself in that manner. It's uncalled for and unorthodox.
Jimmy, what's the psychology behind this? I mean, obviously the young man said that the bishop had this power already. He had people looking up to him. He had, you know, a mega church, all these people. Why then would he choose to target young men as opposed to saying some, you know, and not doing it at all, of course, but maybe older men or older women or some other? Why? What's the psychology behind targeting young men?
Most vulnerable.
Right. A, the most vulnerable. Two, the most easy to influence. And it would not be so easily recognized because of how things were structured in the church in terms of the male academy or whatever it was called. So him spending time with the young men would not have been deemed to be, you know, something wrong. But had he been spending time with too many women, you know, that would have caused suspicion, you know. So it was all part of the plan in terms of things he'd already had in place. And so that's what made it easy to do. If it's all true, and like as I stated, you know, and we have to say allegedly, because he's claiming nothing and they're claiming everything, and if they're willing to give up, you know, their settlement to actually get the truth out, for them the truth seems to be more important than the money, which is an amazing thing. So everybody that was thawing them, oh, they just trying to get paid, yada, 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 well, they've given that up, you know. That's not to say if they write the book, they won't get probably more than $20 million. But, you know, for them, the money, whatever money they get won't be hush money, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so I think that has a lot to do with it. They're vulnerable and they're the most impressionable. And that it wouldn't be frowned upon because it was such a strong presence in his ministry, and I say that loosely, to be a father figure to young men, to bring young men into the fold, to teach them and to grow and develop them. So it was just easy because of everything else he had already outlined.
Okay, so let's move beyond Bishop here for a moment. Let's talk about the occurrences over the years that involve men of the cloth and young boys.
Yeah.
I'm disturbed by the fact that this consistently happens from men of the cloth and to young boys. It's almost as if it is, I don't want to say premeditated, but they seem to have some type of, they profile these kids in the sense that they look for the right ones or the, you know, and to me that's dangerous. Abby, what are your thoughts about that?
Yes. It is dangerous. I'm telling you, it really, really is, and I agree with you. There seems to be a lot of prototyping for young men, and these men are in the position of clergy. And I tell you, one thing that I really looked at is the fact that it's deviant behavior. I don't care if he's a bishop, if he's a pastor, evangelist, whatever have you. This is deviant behavior. And the thing is that a lot of people have stated that, you know, by, you know, the Catholic, you know, religion, you know, prohibits priests. Now they're saying priests can marry, but they have these sexual feelings just as all human beings do. But nevertheless, and I'm not being ill-regressive or being a neo-negative, but hey, there's a lot of, you know, free booty calls that you can make, excuse my terminology, or get them at cheap rates of the opposite sex, but they're not generated toward the opposite sex. They're generated to the same sex gender. So to me, before they allow these people to take these positions, they need to do a little background checking to investigate, have they, you know, had committed any degree of deviance before they're taking this position. Because when you got a person who was a deviant while he was in the theological seminary, and he had these practices and these tendencies, and he did stuff then, what makes you think when he becomes a bishop, or he becomes a monk or another posture in the religious community, what makes you think he's going to translate miraculously and suddenly no longer want to have sex with other boys? You know, it just does not happen like that. So it needs to be a little bit more intense background checking. Y'all know they say first natural, then spiritual. That needs to be part of the natural agenda. But another thing, too, we have to look at the fact of a lot of times as parents, especially as a single parent, when we have young men, especially we as women raising young men, we need to use a little bit more restraints. We talk to our daughters. I know as an educator and a counselor, I've done it. I've talked to my daughter. I've talked to girls in the circle about minding your manners. Don't let boys touch you. Don't let men feel you. Don't sit on no man's lap. We need to educate our young men the same way. Anytime a man want to hug on you, no, he's not your uncle, he's not your brother, whatever have you, and there's a certain way that they hug you. Don't hug them. Come tell an adult. Tell me. You know, there's no way that you're going to spend a night of another man's house. Why? Where's that woman? Come tell me. We need to educate our young men. See, education is the best preventive tool that there is in getting to our young men. As young as they're 7, 6, 7, 8, 5, 4, start teaching them about a good touch, a bad touch, a good connection, bad connection, things that shouldn't happen, things that should happen. And by doing that, these deviants who are taking these positions, we'll put them well out of business. And when they find out these men do this stuff, the law needs to deal a little bit more extensively with them. But it starts with us as parents and caregivers. Educate these young men. We do it to our daughters, but see, the theology behind that is that we raise our daughters, but we love our sons.
Interesting. Jimmy, you had a comment?
I think also to go along with that is not, you know, they also need to be psychologically tested. I mean, it's one thing to do a background check, but it's another thing to check psychologically to see if they are of the right frame of mind to be in these positions.
Yeah.
And that's across the board. That's for anybody that's in a position of trust, whether that's you know,
right.
a pastor, preacher, a priest, a teacher, a counselor, whoever that is, because you see it more and more in those fields, those helping fields of people that are supposed to be helping tend to find themselves more in the role of hurting. And so obviously everybody that's in that field may not be of the mental capacity to handle all that is being leaked upon them. So I think there also should be some sort of, you know, psychological. And I know what the priests and the preachers and the pastors are going to say. They've been called. The Lord called them. Yes, he probably did.
Them.
I'm not, I won't have anything to say about who called you. However, comma, you've got to show, if you
That's
have
right.
that tendency, you have to show some restraint for yourself and get some help. So you're right,
That's
Patrick.
Right.
Over the last years, there's been a lot of incidences
epidemic.
Of people
yeah.
of the cloth that are supposed to be in charge, you know, helping us usher in that spirit and teaching us about God and God's love, that have been guilty or even been accused of such heinous things against children and against
yeah.
women. And, you know, it's horrible. So I'm not sure, you know, when it all started, what happened, where the disconnect is, but you're right that there's a huge disconnect somewhere.
And this is probably has trickled down into a lot of people's mind with regard to the attendance of church, the participating in church, and trying to get more involved. And because, you know, every year we hear something that's more and more disturbing that's coming from that particular church, and every year our participation of the church begins to dwindle. And so I hope that any of the people out there that are listening, the callers, people all over the world, that understand the responsibility of the preacher or the pastor or the minister behind that pulpit. I mean, they
that's
have
right.
such a hold on the congregation because they go to that person, not because of them, but because of their connection to God. And so when they look at that person, they look at somebody that's represented by God, so they open themselves up. But I can say our pastor really talked well today about not believing in man and not taking your problems to man and not telling your secrets to man, but telling them to God. So I could really appreciate the message that we had today to talk along those lines. What do you think, Jima?
I totally agree. And we just have to remember that everybody that we're talking about are human. And humans are flawed individuals. We were born into this world in sin, and so we have to know that we have an abundance amount of issues. But that doesn't excuse away, you know, when you're supposed to respond and react a certain way in certain situations and circumstances. And so we do tend to place certain types of people on pedestals, and in doing that, we allow them some allowances that we wouldn't allow somebody else. And so we've got to do a better job of educating our children. We've got to do a better job of just, as you know, figure out some stuff for yourself. Don't go telling anybody everything that's going on in your world. Because, you know, it's you're going to hear it again. You will hear it again. Guarantee you will hear it again. Yeah. And it's not going to be how you said it. It's going to have some extra stuff added to it. And you're going to have to spend more time trying to undo what was said as opposed to just handling it on your own. And so you have to be able to find that balance, you know, when you are talking to your pastor or priest or whomever, you know, they just a man. You know, they you can talk to God yourself, and hopefully they're teaching you how to do that, because that's what they're supposed to do, is teach us how to, not go do it all for us. You know, they're supposed to teach us how to develop our own relationship with Christ and with God, that then we can go and speak on our own behalf and say, okay, Lord, here's what I'm dealing with. You know, show me somebody that can help me. And that's what he'll do. So that's what they're supposed to do, is to teach us. So we shouldn't hold them to some high, you know, that they're all that and a bag of chips, because they just a man. But they might be a just man, but they're just a man in terms of they got to put on their pants, you know, one leg at a time as well. There's nothing magical about who they are. Well, the magic is in that whose they are and what they believe, and that's what they're supposed to be teaching us about.
Yeah, I want to talk about for a moment the, you know, you mentioned putting people on pedestals and how that works out. I want to talk about two people that I think that our society has put on a pedestal, and that is Will and Jada Pinkett Smith.
Oh yeah. Ooh.
You know, there's been some rumors going around about they were you know, going to split up, but it turns out that, you know, it's not true. While the two may have released a statement claiming that their marriage is intact, friends close to the couple that says that they may not be heading to divorce court, but there are some problems in their relationship. And so, you know, I think our society has looked at that couple, and we put a lot of stock into them. And, you know, we're saying that if, you know, if they can't make it, then who can make it? Well, I'm saying a lot of people can make it. You know, a lot of people can do, you know, we're going to be praying for them. We're going to be hoping that things work out for them. But we can't put them on a pedestal to say that they don't deal with the same everyday situation that we deal with.
That's right.
Right. But I think it's not just so much as them putting them on a pedal. It's just that we rarely get to see people of color in relationships. Let me just put a period there. We very seldom get to see people of color in relationships. Not to mention people of color in relationships that's working. And whatever working means, you know, it's tangible about what you mean by work. But if you look at it, you know, and I was just doing a study in my head as you were talking, you know, and a lot of the blogosphere was saying that's the only couple, but that's not true. You know, you can go back to Magic and Cookie. And if she stayed with Magic through all of his stuff, surely everybody else can figure out what to do. You can go back to Denzel and Paulette, and you can go to Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee.
They were the
original Hollywood couple. And if Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee, you know, we have examples. We just haven't dug deep enough to look at them. We have a lot of examples, you know, that show.
Nick Ashford is out of the country. That's right.
So we have more than Will and Jada. Let's not get it twisted. You know, we have more than Will and Jada, and you know, so we can go a little bit further back than them and find, you know,
Will McCool and Billy Davis. That's right.
Yeah.
Will McCool and Billy Davis.
Couple,
that's right. We got a lot of,
you know, that have made it in the industry, and these are all couples that have made it in the industry. Samuel L. Jackson and his wife, LaTanya. Spike Lee and his wife. I mean, you know, we have examples. And I think, you know, we've just put too much on one because we've kind of, quote-unquote, seen them grow up so to speak. And so we think we have a greater connection with them because we've seen them grow up to be who they are and then their children and all of that, you know, because we think we know them. Like, that's Will and Jada. Like, we know Will and Jada. And we don't be more know Will and Jada than we know Denzel and Paulette. So but that's how we do, because that's how we do the president and Michelle. You know, that's how we do them. You know, so, but because we're happy to see it, because it doesn't, we don't see it that often, and we know black love exists, you know. So the fact that they are a part of that is an awesome thing. But I agree with you. We shouldn't put anybody up on the pedestal, because you put them too high, when they fall, they will crack. They will
crack. And they take us down with them.
Right.
When they fall, we fall too. And so I'm glad you brought up all those different occurrences of black people together and together for an extended period of time that are really, at least in the public eye, show that they love each other. You know,
and look at Mary McCool and Billy Davis. They still perform together after all these years, over 35, 37 years been together. They're still performing as a team. So like she said, it's a lot of examples. And like you said, I think the growing up factor between the two of them has really given us the dynamics and everything. But we have a lot of wonderful examples. And Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis are just phenomenal.
Yeah, so I hope we continue to really show. And I think because we do see them in the public eye, I think it's encouraging to see that. And we need to just see more of that. We need to see more of the family structure. And that's why, you know, I think so many people are in love, especially African Americans, are in love with the president and the first lady, because they are a good example. We don't know what goes on behind the White House doors. You know, I'm sure they have some good days and bad days, too. But when they're in the public eye, or the love that they show for one another is truly genuine. The support that he provides to her and the support that she provides to him is truly genuine. And those examples that we see day in and day out are really encouraging. And I think Will and Jada was just another instance of that. And that's why people were really, really hurt by the notion that their marriage may be in trouble, because they have the money, they have the fame, they have the you know, 2.5 kids, you know. And so all those things are in place for them. And so people tend to say that if they can't make it, then how can I? And I want to encourage people out there not to put them on pedestals. They are human beings, like Jima said, but at the same time, just know that there are occurrences out there of black love and showing black love. So,
and then you got Bill and Camille Cosby, too. Oh, so, you know.
That's right. Oh, we forgot about them, didn't we? Wow. Sure did. Good swanking couple, yes.
So, Abby, I'm going to give you any final comments, any closing comments.
Wonderful show. Enjoyed it. Colorful, creative dialogue. Look to be with you guys next week. It was awesome.
All right. You want to talk about your show?
Oh, yes. The Esquire Strikes Back, 3:30 p.m. on each Friday. Simply go to the network, type in the show name, and you talk about the host with the most from coast to coast, only second to Patrick Cook.
You
got to get some hot details. And we uncovered the three top terrorist organizations in the world that are planning to launch a synchronized attack right here on our soil, which is the Al-Qaeda network, the Taliban, and the Tamil Tigers. Gave some insights and information about them. And also host on Mondays and Wednesdays at 4:30 p.m. It's called Ask the Esquire. We're going in-depth into the very essence of these terrorist movements and the 2,500 sleeper cells that are right here in the continental United States of America, waiting for that grand call to launch an attack.
Wow. Jima, any final comments?
This was a great show. I enjoyed it, and I wish that we could continue to just uplift one another, have great dialogue about what's going on in the world. We kind of give everybody a little piece of everything. You get some politics, you get some sports, you get some entertainment. You know, you get what's going on. You get current events. And so I think that's a great opportunity for us to share to everyone about what's going on. So I was excited about today's show. And as usual, Mr. Cook, you're an excellent host.
Oh, wonderful. The top notch. Woody Woo, he's only second to me. That makes you the very best. The prima donna. The star premier attraction. Give you a hand. Woody Woo.
Abby, you are tons of fun. We really appreciate you being on. Well, that's our show for today. I want to thank all our listeners out there for tuning in. I want to thank my co-host, Jima. It's always a pleasure having you in.
Yay.
Thank you for our guest visit from Abby the Esquire, the Motor City Maharani. Just a quick reminder, check out our daily blog at currentevents24-7.blogspot.com. That's CURRENTEVENTS 24-7. That's currentevents24-7.blogspot.com for commentary and a unique perspective on the current events in sports, entertainment, and politics. Also, to all my colleagues, I want to encourage you to sign up for my upcoming social media marketing webinar, Saturday, September the 10th at 10 o'clock a.m. Just go to TaylorMade101.com and click on social media marketing. Here's why. The internet is exploding faster than anything right now. And just a few years ago, there were many barriers to getting online. Computers were hard to afford. Internet service providers were costly. And transferring data over the phone lines was a nightmare. Let's face it, those challenges are long gone. The smartphone, the tablet, is capable of doing what the PC was doing less than a decade ago. So register for the seminar and find out how you can get into the game and to start turning your web surfing into some extra cash. Again, that's TaylorMade101.com and click on social media marketing. If you're in business or just want to make a few extra dollars, you're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. And don't forget to bookmark this site. Until next time, remember, it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to Current Events with Patrick Cook. You're listening to the sounds of George Spencer and Sweet Dreams. Take us away, George.